The vast majority of law firms do not think of excellence when it comes to their intake system, and it costs them, if they're sizable, it costs them millions.
How much did you invest? Did you invest 10 to 20 grand a month, or did you invest 100 grand a month for, you know, 4 months? And I know those numbers are hard to kind of fathom, but when we're talking about economies and CPAs, it's all relative to what a client's worth.
You're listening to the Grow Law Firm Podcast, where each guest shares actionable, practical ideas with you on how to get more clients, expand your reach, and grow your law firm's revenue and profit. Here's your host, Sasha Burson.
Hi there. I have a small but really meaningful favor to ask you. You know, I watch At The Stats on our YouTube channel and Spotify channel, wherever people, most people listen and watch our podcast. And I see that over 80% of everybody who listens to it regularly is not a subscriber. I'm asking you to subscribe to this channel. And the reason for that is my mission and the mission of my team is to help as many small law firm owners to learn how to transform their law firms into better businesses, and so they in turn enjoy better lives. When you hit subscribe button, you tell these platforms that this is content worth listening, worth viewing, and they in turn will show it to many other small law firm owners and hopefully help me fulfill our mission of helping them create a better business and enjoy better lives. So would you please do me this favor? It would mean the world to me. And hit the subscribe button. And my promise to you is that I will continue to work hard at creating good content with practical ideas that help you and your teams grow better law firms. Thank you. Welcome to another wonderful episode of Grow Law Firm Podcast. I have a really, really important guest here today. Here's why I find Chris Dreyer to be a very important podcast guest. If you're serious, and I mean really serious, really committed to growing your law firm, you got to listen to Chris. There are two reasons. Not only has he built a service business that is not very different from a law firm. A service business is a service business is a service business of 40 plus employees. That is a sizable team. I'm going to guesstimate that your revenues, if you have 40 plus employees and they're in the US, it's 8 million plus just gross revenue for the firm. It is hard to build that size of a business, higher than that, 10 plus.
So we got, we have about 80 full-time, another 20, 30 subs, and we're targeting about 21, 22 million this year.
Amazing. This is your gross revenue. This is not pass-through revenue. So 21
million. No pass-through.
Amazing. So I looked at your website, and there were like 40 plus specialists, and I'm like, so I'm just multiplying that by 200 times. Anyway, here's why it's really important to listen to Chris. $21 million in revenue. He built a service business that's that size, but not only that. Chris has been working with very successful law firm owners for years. He's been interviewing very successful law firm owners for years. He knows the tenets of building a very successful business, period. Talking to Chris is like talking to the author of Think and Grow Rich. And here's why. He interviewed something like 100 very successful people over numerous years. And through that learning, through those interviews, he developed a formula for thinking. I think he should have called the book Think, Do, and Grow Rich, but he only called it Think and Grow Rich. So, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Sasha, first of all, thank you so much for the compliment and kind words. I'm excited to be here, excited to chat, and just thank you. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. You've built something that is amazing. It is rare that there aren't very many marketing companies, for lawyers or not for lawyers, that have achieved $20 plus million in revenue. So congrats on your success. Obviously, it took some time, effort, money, and knowledge. Nothing like that happens by an accident. You can get to $1 million by accident. You can't get to $21 million in revenue by accident and continue growing. So share the journey, the main tenets, what you have learned from other very successful law firm owners.
Yeah, you may give you like the quick overview of like the growth.
Yeah.
So my background, I was a history teacher.
I did not know that.
Was sitting in a detention room you know, with the kids after school, and I typed in how to make money online, and I took Ed Dale's affiliate marketing course. By the end of my second year, I was making significantly more than I was teaching doing affiliate marketing. So we ranked, I ranked number one for Double Chin, for Staying Concrete, for many, many free phrases, portable generators, all kinds of just crazy stuff. And that was thriving until about 2011, that first Penguin algorithm. Because back then, all I had to do to rank was get an e-zine article, a couple, you know, I didn't need very many links. And that first algorithm hit, and it really scrutinized your link quality. And it was, you know, the Penguin algorithm. And my revenue went down to about 2K. So back then, you went to Craigslist to look for an opportunity. And I applied for SEO positions, and I applied to so many that I hit their filter, and I got three interviews, and all three offered me the job, and they were all remote positions. And this is, you know, pre-COVID, pre-Zoom. And most people would say, well, like, which one did you take? And I took all three. And the reason is I had an affiliate team. So I ended up being the best employee at all three agencies. And essentially I worked at those agencies, and I saw what I liked, I didn't like. And after about a year and a half, I decided to start my own agency. And I was very transparent with them on what I was doing. I trained my replacement. I never solicited any of their clients and just went out and did my own thing. Now, fortunately, those three agencies were like generalist agencies, and like legal wasn't like their whole world, right? And so I did that, and the first few years was, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. It was, I wasn't saving money. I wasn't as mature as I am today. I wasn't investing. And so I had to do a lot of belly to belly networking, meeting people, you know, build relationships for referrals. So that took me to, let's say, 3 to 4 million. Then I expanded my marketing team, started doing a little bit more on the branding side and the positioning side. And let's say that took me to 8 million. And across this whole way, I'm bringing more and more stuff in-house for control and developing our skills as leaders through EOS and Traction. At about the 8 million mark, I started to look at sales more. So we started to invest in outbound. We started to expand the sales team. And then it was only a few in-house and sales AEs, but I was outsourcing $30,000, $40,000 a month to outbound sales professionals. That took us to, say, 12 or 13 million. And then where the change really occurred, for at least for us in the professional services space, was a combination of a few things. Was one, getting better talent leaders, directors, executives, and then expanding the sales force even further. So now we have 11 or 12 sales professionals, a combination of sales enablement, BDRs, AEs. And so now we're hunting and not just farming the leads that are coming inbound through marketing, and we don't let anything slip through the cracks. And basically that's how we grew. And on the back end, this goes without saying, you have to do good work for the clients to keep them, right? So you have to be really focused on delivery, generating an ROI. And we really invested in our people, their training, their processes, and surrounding them with the best talent we could. And that's kind of how we ended up. That's a very, you know, summarized version, but that's kind of the different phases, I would say.
So this is give or take about 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. About 10 years.
Yeah.
Yep.
So from zero to $21 million in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So something that most will never accomplish. It's the truth, right? There's a fraction of 1% that will ever get to $10 million, let alone $20 million in revenue. How does everything that you have learned along the way, your personal journey, and the hundreds of very successful law firm owners that you have interviewed over the years and worked for and worked with over the years, how does that translate into building a substantial law firm?
really big question. So the first thing I'll say is many attorneys, they don't think about capital allocation properly on the front end. So they know that they need to market. They know that they need to get sales and do intake, but most of them are focused on the delivery side. Now, there's varying levels of quality and what we refer to as operational excellence, right, for profit margins and things on the back end. But really, if you're especially the pre-lit firms, you have to originate your own cases. And most of the time, they're not deploying enough capital. And I'll say this, like individual law firms, especially in the personal injury space where it's so saturated, and you, when you don't deploy enough capital, you don't get enough data to make decisions, to understand if it's working properly, to feed the Google algorithm intelligence to you know, especially on the Google ad side, to serve your ads better. You don't get the economies from your radius that you're targeting. You know, all of these factor in. So you take something like Google ads when people say, oh, it didn't work for me. Well, how much did you invest? Did you invest 10 to 20 grand a month, or did you invest 100 grand a month for, you know, 4 months? And I know those numbers are hard to kind of fathom, but when we're talking about economies and CPAs, it's all relative to what a client's worth. So I would say the biggest thing, even on the SEO side, you and I both know this, Sasha. I mean, some clients want to rank in a major market and they've got 20 referring domains. Well, no matter how you look at it, there's a cost involved. Labor to acquire the links, all these factor in. It's just typically they think about capital allocation incorrectly.
What's the right way of thinking about capital allocation?
I think that the correct way to look at it is look at it from a percentage perspective. So you have to have delivery and the funds to serve your client, right? You can't jeopardize that. So I think, but if you look at it as a percentage and say, hey, I'm going to commit to 20%. And, you know, Mike Michalowicz has that profit first book, and it's kind of a lean methodology. Like, well, out of the 100% I get, 20 is going into marketing no matter what. So every single year, as your gross revenue increases, so is your marketing allocation. I mean, you look at the biggest, right? Morgan & Morgan on Nielsen's, you know, Vivix data, they spent $201 million on traditional marketing last year. You look at number two, it's like 50 million. Most major markets, they're spending $1 million a month. So if you're trying to crack one of these major cities and you're not spending $1 million a month, well, it's just the capital to deploy, to stand out, to be memorable is significantly higher in the personal injury space than, say, family law, criminal defense, and these other areas.
Well, some people, when they hear these numbers, they may be gasping for air.
Yeah, and it's true, and it's all relative, right? And I think there's, when it comes to capital, there's many ways to think about it. Like you can take on debt, right? Assuming you've isolated a channel that's effective, you can partner with other firms. Maybe you have something outside of just a, you know, referral contingency, a third. Maybe you partner, right? And have like an exclusive relationship. There's many ways to look at capital and to acquire capital outside of just, you know, the bootstrapped, you know, free cash flow.
Makes sense. Thinking of smaller law firms, how much would you recommend to allocate in capital toward case acquisition?
Yeah, you know, it's all relative, right? So you can start bootstrapped. You know, if you don't have any capital, network. You know, go to the other big firms in their market. What cases are you turning down? Oh, SSDI cases, premises cases, I'm your guy, right? And so there's ways to kind of piggyback off of these other big marketers to get your start. You know, the belly-to-belly things that don't scale, meaning, you know, shaking hands and meeting people on a personal level go a long way on the referrals. You know, getting creative with the guerrilla type marketing and grassroots marketing strategies to be a known entity in your community, be a, you know, work your sphere of influence for referrals. So those are the things you can do really early on. I would just say that, you know, dependent upon your goals, you know, you got to work backwards, right? So if your cost to acquire a client, you're looking at, you know, $2,000, then, you know, how much capital do you need to deploy to hit your revenue goals? So, and every market's different, right? If you're acquiring cases in California for $6K, it may be fine. If you're acquiring cases for $6K in Maryland for auto, you're in trouble. You're going to be upside down. But so it's really relative. But I think super long-winded way. In the beginning, use your sphere of influence. Do the things that don't scale. I would also say that in the beginning, you want to really focus on direct response and less on brand. But as you start to develop more revenue, those percentages will change, where maybe in the beginning it's 80% direct response, 20% brand. Maybe it's now 40 direct response, 60% brand, and you can consistently, you know, change those allocations.
And there are a lot of people who will not know what you mean by saying direct response. So would you please elaborate on that?
Yeah. So direct response is more of an advertising means of that's like a short-term orientation. I would classify most ads as direct response. So meaning I'm going to advertise on Google Ads and I want an immediate action by the consumer. The consumer has intent to hire an attorney. So it's a short-term orientation. Now, typically, because it's a short-term orientation, they don't necessarily know who you are. The cost to acquire a client is going to be more, right? Versus brand, it's being a known entity. It's a long-term orientation. Sometimes people, you know, I did an episode with Kyle Backus and he talked about investing in TV and he wasn't even expecting a return for the first year, right? It's a really long-term orientation. And we know, you know, that Google leaks, that Google likes brands. And so that is how you get cases, you know, under that $1,000 mark. It's because people know you. They're coming directly to you. You're not paying the channel costs. So that's really the difference. It's, you know, I would say brand is more long-term orientation, where direct response is more short-term orientation.
Yeah. Direct response is usually, it seems cheaper upfront, mm-hmm. because it is, because you don't have to invest very much long-term to get those leads, to get those cases. Whereas with brand, like you said, that guy, over a year to get to initial ROI, probably not a solid ROI, but initial ROI. So it's a considerable investment, very considerable investment. And for most smaller law firms, it's not fathomable.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, maybe you get your first billboard and then you get your second, and then maybe you're doing remnant inventory to get them cheaper. And so there's a lot of strategies that come into play here. The other thing too, I don't think that's talked about enough, is the creative. So a lot of law firms will say the creative and the positioning. So they'll say, oh, I'm going to go do TV or billboards. And if they don't have something memorable or a unique brand, then they have to spend an absolute fortune before a consumer can remember them. But if they do something wacky or a little crazy, they may not have to spend the same amount to be memorable.
Yep, that makes sense. I live in an area, I'm north of Chicago, where Lerner & Rowe, one of the largest PI law firms, they decided to go big on Chicago about 2 years ago. Every bus stop, a ton of billboards, bus wraps. You can't help but see their ads. What makes them really memorable is it's always on a yellow background. It's always ranked or rated number one, and there are a number of stars, and there are two guys standing there smiling. Every
big
single
smile,
ad
Lynn.
The same.
Yep.
That's it. That's it. By the way, his story is that he started with one billboard back in 98 in Vegas. That was it. Somebody told him, invest big into one billboard. He did. He told me. I was like, I signed 66 cases that month off of one. You can't do that today. You're not going to sign 66
especially
cases.
Especially not in Vegas. There's probably four other billboards.
Right
yeah,
next to that one. Yeah.
You know, and he has a memorable tagline. You know, it's kind of, you know, in a wreck, get a check. like it's very top of mind. It's catchy. It's kind of got that call to action, you know, in there. So yeah. And like you said, honestly, I was in Vegas for MTMP around the same time. And my wife and I were having dinner at the Spago. It's right across from the Bellagio, right at the Bellagio. And there goes a Lerner and Rowe bus completely wrapped. And I texted Glenn. I said, I spy Glenn Lerner. And he goes, only got a few of them.
Few hundred, he meant. Few hundred.
Right.
Yeah, an interesting guy for sure. And he has grown also from very humble beginnings to, mm-hmm. you know, I met him a couple of years ago at the conference. And I think at that time they had 450 attorneys, which probably would make him second best or second largest or third largest in the nation.
Yeah, he's up there for sure. Yeah. Let me see. I got some data. I'm the data guy here. Yeah. Lerner and Rowe, 25 million from May to May 23 to April 30th, 24, according to Vivix. So decent. That's just the mostly outdoor too, by the way.
Right. 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 So it's a lot more. So you could say 450 attorneys, if they're all fairly optimized, you can multiply that by $400,000 per attorney, give or take 160 million, maybe more. And they're probably investing 15-20% into marketing and advertising.
Yeah, no clue on his numbers, but certainly yeah. big, and he's definitely growing.
Yeah, very substantial firm. So the number one tenet for growing a business, obviously, is budget properly into case acquisition. And that budget, like you mentioned, it could be monetary if you got the money, or it can be on your calendar. Put in the time and effort to go shake hands, meet people, put in that sweat equity into getting those dollars in so that you can invest into first direct response marketing, short term, Google Ads, sponsored directory listings, Avo Super Lawyers. People go there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
LS work and generate those cases at, depending on what geographical market you're in, small, if it's like Omaha, Nebraska, you're probably going to invest 10, 12, 15%. If it's mm-hmm. New York City, it could be 20, 22, 25%. But invest those dollars into direct response. And then once you get, you mentioned, I think 3, 4, 5 million in revenue, you should start investing into brand advertising. Long-term commitment, higher payoff in the long term.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with all that. Forbes Advisors, another one right now. Really good placement. It used to be Expertise. They've lost some ground. You know, there's also the paper lead options. You got to be careful there. We both know that.
Very careful.
But those are some options. You know, like Walker, they've got their Los Defensores. So if you're, you know, you have a Latin firm and you do Spanish cases, then, you know, that could be an option in terms of short-term orientation. So there's some options there too. Quintessa Marketing, I think they do. I don't know, you know, how they're originating cases, but I know they do a lot of cases. So, there's some options there, and I don't have any affiliation. I'm just talking in the.
Sure. But thanks yeah. for sharing these. So for your company, for your mm-hmm. marketing company, the second tenet was making sure that you have a solid sales team with no lead leakage. Explain what that means and how that information translates into actually managing a sales team in the law firm. And I on purpose call it a sales team. I know lawyers hate that word. They mm-hmm. call it intake, but the reality is it is a sales team.
Yeah, I mean, so you know as well as I, no matter if it's the law firm or us, if a lead comes in, it has to be handled quickly or they're going to use someone else, right? So if a law firm misses a call, that individual is going to call another firm. If they, you know, they, so not only that, you're going to lose placement on local services ads. So it's essential to be very responsive. The same goes for us. And it's honestly, one of my pet peeves is a lot of digital agencies. And I have no idea. I'm just saying, and I don't know. These coaches will recommend these foot in the door audits, right? These comprehensive audits in the sales cycle. And here's the deal. If you do the initial call and you say you're going to sell an audit and it's going to take 2 weeks to prepare, well, what does the firm do? They have 2 weeks to go talk to other agencies, right? And by the way, if you're a legal marketing agency, you should be doing that anyways, right? Because you need to understand where the holes are to pass on to your delivery team. But it's no, when I mean no leaks, I mean no forms missed. I mean getting scheduling as quickly as possible, even the same day, shortening the sales cycle, going through your CRM and reactivating people that went to other agencies, following up with them in the past, just being a known quantity through providing value, not trying to sell, but actually committing to value. So that's where, you know, documentation of notes in the CRM had to be excellent. You know, maybe an individual was changing their CRM and, you know, you can help there, even though that's not something you offer, you can provide recommendations or be a connector. And, you know, it's also for our side, it's contacting the right individuals. It's the sales enablement side, which to me, I think is a lost function on legal. That's beside itself, and how important data is. It's making sure you're contacting the right individuals.
Yeah, for sure. What we're seeing, and you probably have seen it numerous times as well, is that a law firm has a great marketing team that delivers plenty of leads, and then you see that leakage.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Substantial leakage, meaning calls go unanswered or calls are not handled in the proper way. And by the time attorney gets back to that prospect, 24 hours pass, 48 hours pass, 72 hours. They have already talked to three other attorneys. They have no preference for you whatsoever.
Yeah.
Gone. You spend the money. You spend the money getting that lead. You spend the money in talking to that person in the first place, and then you call them back a day late. Gone. Very expensive problem.
Yeah, it's wild. I was listening to a call the other day because my team's like, you got to listen to this. And the intake person, like, first of all, this person's in the hospital, hurt badly. They call in and she's kind of nervous. And like, and the intake person says, I need you to be beat, brief, B-R-I-E-F. And we're like, oh my God, like what? Oh, this is wild.
There goes that $2 million case.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere else, who is not going to be brief.
Mm-hmm.
That is insane. We're talking about lead leakage.
Yep.
And be brief, which just blew my mind. I think if the law firm owner listened to that conversation, their blood pressure would probably have gone up.
Oh, yeah. We sent several recordings to that individual firm. Yeah, there's, to be honest, though, it's, some people don't like, there's an accountability thing, right? There's joint accountabilities in a relationship when you work with a vendor. You do your part, we do our part. Like a lot of times the joint accountability for the firm is to give excellent client service so that they can generate reviews, right? We know how important reviews are for LSA and Google Maps. And there's only so many things the marketing agency can do. Right, we can supply the tools. We, you know, I guess we could call their clients, but you know, if they gave us case management access, but it's more challenging, right? So there's joint accountabilities, and one of them, if you're working with a marketing agency, is that you have that they have a good intake system.
Yeah, I find that the vast majority of law firms do not think of excellence when it comes to their intake system. And it costs them, if they're sizable, it costs them millions. If they're on the smaller side, it definitely costs them hundreds of thousands of dollars every single year, multiplied by 10 years. It's a retirement plan. It's a yacht. It's a second house. It buys a lot of things. Simply focusing on your intake and saying, we're going to be excellent at this thing. It's actually more important than being excellent. I believe it's more important than being excellent in service.
I agree. And I would say, you know, it's easy. I would just say that I know there's many law firms probably listening that believe that they have good intakes. I would just say, why don't you spend a little bit of money to get a third party evaluation? Why don't you go to someone like Legal Intake Pros or a company to evaluate it and see for sure? right? Because it's, you know, the Dunning-Kruger thing. Like, we're all at some point Dunning-Krugers in different different capacities. Like, but you don't know what real quality is unless you have an expert evaluate it.
Yeah. I was leading a consulting company a little over a decade ago and worked with a plethora of various businesses. And one business, they were looking for ways to optimize, but they didn't know what to optimize. They're like, we know we're missing out on some business, but we don't know why. Mm-hmm. We started by testing their front desk. That receptionist at the time, this is circa 2011, give or take, they paid the receptionist $40,000 a year, and she cost them a little over $1 million. Just the way she handled incoming calls. That was it. W2, wow. 40,000, total cost, $1,040,000.
Yep. Yeah, there's so much when it comes to training to, you know, like we see this, right? A lot of times firms will get a one-star review because they turned down a case. And it's just, it's coaching, it's education. It's, hey, you know, instead of saying we don't take this, blah, 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 blah. You say, absolutely, I can help you out. Call this person. Don't give them the state, you know, the bar number. Like, be helpful. Like, Google 2 seconds. Like, hey, we don't do family law, or, you know, absolutely, I'm happy to help you. Here's a firm in your area that does family law. I would definitely give them a call, and they should be able to help you. And then it's like a good experience. Like they got value out of the conversation and their time, as opposed to, oh, sorry, here's a number. Good luck.
Yeah. Yeah. Customer experience is a big thing, but most law firm owners, in my experience, are not really focused on that. They think that as long as they deliver the results that their clients pay them for, it's good enough or it's great enough and they should be getting referrals. But I think today, good enough is not enough. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been enough in a long time.
Yeah, there's nuances, right? There, it depends the firm. Like, you got your pre-lit shops that you got a case manager that's got 150 to 200 cases. Like, how can you give good client service? Like, you're just going to give the minimum, you know, the basic updates, versus if you say have a higher case selection criteria and maybe you only have 7-8 cases that trial attorneys work in, and you have an assistant or a case manager, paralegal with that individual, you can give them very deep, you know, updates because you're not working on 200. You know them intimately. You probably met them in person. And it comes down to like the client experience versus the customer experience, where the customer is like the commodity or the widget on the assembly line.
Yeah. What's the best customer experience or client experience, rather, that you have seen, and how did that law firm set it up? Or maybe you can speak about the client experience that you create for your clients.
So we work with a lot of exceptional firms that have a lot of reviews and great reputation. I don't really get to see the inner workings of that. And unfortunately, I'd like to learn more about that. And I think if there's a firm, you know, listening that has great customer experience, I would love for you to reach out to Sasha and maybe you can, you know, provide us some feedback. I'll say, for us, a lot of it comes down to setting expectations on the front end. We have an internal process that's called teach our clients not to be crazy. And clients become crazy when expectations aren't set.
Yeah.
So when they don't know, right, then it's because you haven't set expectations. If you say you're going to get content by this time, here's how long it takes to rank, here's when we're going to be, here's the next meeting where we're going to talk, and you set these expectations, they don't become problematic. And so we found that, I think, postmortems, when you have a good or bad experience, those like retrospectives to really evaluate what went right, what went wrong, to improve your processes, having training, personality assessments, you know, those DISC personality assessments, those influencers, those IDs, there's a lot that goes into it, but I think it comes down to care. That's really what it comes down to, like actually caring that for the client and ensuring that you're providing value and that they're happy. That's if you're caring and you truly have that empathy and accountability when things go wrong, right? We're not perfect. You know, we're humans. And, but it's handling it quickly, you know, transparently. And that's what it comes down to, in my opinion.
Yeah, we, whenever we work with new clients, we teach them that the service that you deliver should be highly referable. Like, don't expect referrals because you delivered good service. It should be highly referable. As in, if it's just good, it's not referable. It has to be great. Not just the outcome, but the whole experience. I love it. What you call it? Teach your clients not to go crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very clear expectations.
Yeah, it's, we all have these common questions that our clients ask, whether you're an attorney or an agency. There's you jot those questions down and you answer them on the front end. You put them in FAQs. You answer them multiple times. You don't just say it one time, this is our content process. It's listed in multiple documentation and they're kind of beat over the head, right? And then there's like absolutely no reason that they hadn't received it, right? It's multiple mediums. Yeah.
It makes great sense and reminds me of a story. A number of years ago, I worked with a good friend of mine. I was president of his company. And there was a point where he came to the production team and he said, well, we need to do this. And they're like, well, we don't know how to do it. And he said, what do you mean? We gave you training on this. And they were like, 6 months ago. He expected them to remember how to do a technical task because the training was delivered 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I see that also with law firms where we trained our people how to do business development in 2016. They should know. They should be executing on it. They should be bringing in business because we trained them in 2016. We see this. It's pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, training's ongoing. One of the things that we implemented, I think it's really simple, and it's like alliteration. It's memorable. We do a Wednesday wisdom, and we have our leaders train on the respective disciplines. So at least every week, you're getting together as a team and training on a particular discipline, right? And it's also like you have to do it. It's part of their KPIs. It's mandatory. And over time, those Wednesday wisdoms, even though it's once a week, they just significantly compound.
Yeah. Do you do that company wide or do you split it up departmentally?
Departmentally, but company wide. Yeah.
Got it. So every department head does their Wednesday wisdom with their respective teams.
Yep.
Yeah, imagine how much progress you would have in a law firm if they had an equivalent of a Wednesday wisdom on the marketing side, because usually once they get to a certain size, there is some sort of a marketing team, or at least a marketing person who could be educating the intake team and their leader, and the intake leader would be educating their team, and the operations leader would be educated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In a year's time, the improvement would be, as long as those learnings are actionable, the improvements across all departments could be tremendous. But mm-hmm. I don't think very many law firms actually do any of this.
Yeah, I think the better ones do, right?
The better ones do.
Yeah, and I think there's rule by abdication and there's rule by delegation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, when you delegate, you create processes and training and you create other leaders. When you rule by abdication, it's oh, here you go, it's on you, and you kind of walk away. And I think there's two types of ways of scaling. And I think by delegation as opposed to abdication, this is significantly more effective.
Yeah. Love this concept. I know you're a big fan of profit first principle. Can you explain what that means in practice? How to apply it if whoever's listening or watching this, they haven't heard about this?
Yeah, I'll do my best. You know, most people, when they think of profit, they think of I receive income, then I subtract my expenses, and then I get my profit. It's at the end. Profit first is more of a lean methodology. It's where first I get the income, and the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to take profit and pay myself. So I get $100 and let's say I'm going to allocate 20% to profit. I'll take that $20, put it in a profit account, and then I have to work off of 80. So it forces you to be profitable on the front end, and it's not as an afterthought. And it also teaches you better business principles about being lean. A lot of times there's multiple analogies that Mike Michalowicz uses in the book. And for example, when you brush your teeth, a lot of times people get that brand new thing of toothpaste and they squeeze a whole lot on that toothbrush and it's falling off all over the place, right? And you're just being very wasteful and you brush your teeth, right? No problem. But once we get to the end, we're like rolling up that toothpaste all the way and you still get the toothpaste and it still brushes your teeth, but you're utilizing it in a lean methodology. So it's just not being wasteful. So that's what profit first is. It's when you take it on the front end, it forces you to be lean. And it's just a different type of approach to kind of forcing profitability into your head.
Yeah. Let me put little numbers on it. So imagine that you're operating a $5 million law firm and you're mapping out next year. So we're recording this June 2024. Let's say you're watching this in October and you're now in the planning period of 2025. And you're like, next year, I don't want to make $1 million net profit. I want to make $1.4 million net profit. Hopefully you have a fractional CFO who is going to help you, because lawyers usually do not have the skill set to do this on their own. You need to have a fractional CFO who is going to put those numbers on a digital paper and show you how to get to $1.4 million. They can go through your various expenses in the year that's just about to be over and say, like, here's where you could have cut, but you didn't, but you can cut going into 2025. Stay disciplined. We'll review those numbers every month so we do not get wasteful, do not become wasteful once again. And we're going to get you that $1.4 million because you started with that profit first. Like on December 31st, 2025, I want to see $1.4 million pre-tax. How do I get there? You map it out and then you just stick to that discipline while also maintaining some flexibility, because economy changes. Things can change. You should have some cushion there. You should be looking to grow your revenue and profitability through better cost management mechanisms. But if you do that, chances are within 5, 7, 10 years, you're going to amass much greater wealth than you would otherwise, because you are doing this on purpose rather than by default, like squeezing the remnants of the toothpaste at the end of the year.
Very well said. Couldn't agree more.
It's a really powerful concept, just incredibly powerful concept. And I think I did business consulting for 3-4 years. I have never seen that effectively applied in any of our clients' businesses. None. Not a single one.
You know, it's agency side, the cash flow implications, right? We're paid on the front end as opposed to, you know, contingency on the back end. But I think you can still put those principles into place. And I think also when you're taking profit on the front end, it forces you to be creative to solve problems. And it prevents things like overhiring and maybe gets you to think about utilization and technology and things like that to solve problems where you may not have done that by just, oh, we got enough. And by the end, before you know it, you took all your profit and now it's out the door.
Yeah, 100%. All right, let's summarize this. So the main tenets that we talked about, number one, proper budget allocation to acquiring new business. Number two, no leakage in your intake. And I love the idea of bringing in a third party to audit it. If you think it's good, terrific. They may make it better. You may think that it's good and it's not good, and they will make it a lot better. And even if it's close to excellence, there's usually some room for improvement there. Operational excellence, really important. Just make sure that every time you deliver a service, it is a referable service. And finally, on the financial side, profit first, strong cost control mechanisms, and you're going to thrive. You do everything right, you're just going to thrive. There is no way around it.
Well said.
Chris, how do people I think a lot of most people who are in the, at least in the personal injury space, have heard of rankings.io. How do they find you on LinkedIn? How do they connect with you if they want to consult with you further?
Yeah, I mean, the most, like you said, the most active I am is on LinkedIn. If you just search for Chris Dreyer and message me there, I'll get it. But if you just want to contact me direct by email, it's just chris@rankings.io.
Love it. I'm also going to put in a little plug. I saw that you have your first conference. I believe it's called PIMCon. That's coming up sometime this fall, right?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. So my team's probably like, oh, phew. Yeah, it's PIMCon.org. It's a personal injury marketing conference. We got some big speakers. We got, Dan Morgan, Alexander Shinara, James Helm, some really big PI players in the space. And then it's all centered around marketing, and that's September 15th through 17th in Scottsdale.
Amazing. So if you're a leading API firm, not to miss conference.
Yeah, it's going to be really actionable on how to generate leads.
Yeah, PIMCon.org.
Correct. Thank you.
Awesome. Check it out. Chris, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Sasha, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast. If you liked the ideas shared in this episode, help a fellow lawyer out by sharing a link to the episode. This episode is powered by the team of experts in client attraction, growlawfirm.com. Do you want a complimentary growth plan for your law firm? Request it at growlawfirm.com/blueprint.